You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good afternoon, everybody. Okay, so I'm going to just try it one more time. I know it's late in the afternoon, but I come from a Baptist church where we do call and response. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
All right. Thank you all for coming on this late afternoon on a Monday here in not-so-steamy Washington, D.C., for our event that is focused on broadband in the President's Infrastructure Plan. We're looking forward to a very, very engaged conversation. We're joined by a very notable guest today. My name is Nicole Turner-Lee. I'm a fellow in the Center for Technology Innovation and Governance Studies here at Brookings. And just excited that we're actually having this conversation. And some people asked, do you want to have this conversation before the end of summer? And I said, I sure do, because perhaps we'll get a little bit of clarity on what this infrastructure plan may actually look like. So we're really excited to actually have this conversation today. We will be joined by someone who I've dearly admired and looked at in terms of her activity on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, a committee that has just been near and dear to my heart, being a person who's an avid technology follower. She is no stranger to this conversation, no stranger to the Hill. Small businesswoman, author, a mother, a grandmother, member of Congress, Representative Marsha Blackburn is here to actually provide us with remarks. She began her elected service in 1998 as a Tennessee state senator. Her Senate career was marked by her commitment to fiscal common sense and government accountability. She's become known to Tennesseans for holding budget schools, both in her district and across the state, identifying ways, proposing realistic spending cuts, and offering a solution for a state in a budget crunch. She is often selected by her colleagues to lead the charge for common sense reform. In February 2010, she was selected to represent conservative views on healthcare reform at the President's Blair House Summit. 2012, she co-chaired the platform for the Republican Convention. She served as Republican whip every Congress, holds a seat on House Energy and Commerce. I want a bio just like you, Representative. And she is currently a ranking leader on the chairman of the Subcommittee on Communications Technology on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. So we're hoping to have this set up, and I'll introduce our panelists afterwards, after she's done, where she will begin the conversation, and then we'll be joined by three panelists that I will introduce by name as they approach the stage, and we'll sort of talk about what this actually looks like. Ladies and gentlemen, let us welcome Congressman Marsha Blackburn to the stage.
Thanks, Nicole, and thank you to each of you for being here. Nicole and I were at a dinner one night. Yvette Clark and I were being honored for bipartisanship and working on some issues together. And with us being on energy and commerce, I think it's fair to say the conversation evolved much toward communications and technology and what we're going to do about meeting the needs that our nation has for broadband. And I think it is fair to say that our president is pushing us toward a very aggressive agenda when it comes to infrastructure. And if you were to get in the car with me and drive through my 19 counties, 10,000 square miles of my fabulous district in Tennessee, you would see that 16 of the 19 counties are rural. And when I go into those meetings with the chamber, with the Rotary Club, with different churches, with schools, the number one thing I hear about, the number one infrastructure issue is broadband. When are we going to have access to high-speed internet? And the reason it is so acute is that you can't reach a lot of the other goals and hopes and dreams and aspirations that communities have and that families have without it. And it's kind of that balance that we hit with a high-tech need, and it allows us to have more engagement or high touch in our lives. And that is what our communities are looking for. When you're talking with mayors in our district or county commissioners or chamber chairmen, they will say, well, we thought we had someone who was coming here with a factory or with the call center, but we did not have access to high-speed internet. You will also hear your nurses and doctors over at the hospital talk about not being able to triage many times because they don't have access to healthcare informatics, telemedicine concepts, things that they feel like they need. And whether it is a high school student or an elementary teacher or someone who has left the workforce and is going through a jobs retraining program, they will talk about wanting to stream classes and having that access. I was a few weeks ago in a community in my district and made some remarks, and at the end of it, a lady came up to me and she said, thank you for talking about broadband and about that importance. And I said, well, thank you for listening and paying attention. And she said, I have to tell you, she said, this is my daughter. She's in high school. And I'm going back and doing some training because I want to be a nurse, an LPN. And in order to do that, I have to stream some classes. And this particular week, it had taken her 4 hours to stream a 45-minute lecture. Now think about that. 4 hours to stream a 45-minute lecture. In some of my counties, we still have children and parents. They come home, the kids come home from school, the parents come home from work, they have dinner, and then everybody loads back in the minivan and they drive into town to the parking lot of the McDonald's or the library or the hospital so that they can get access to wireless and the kids can do their homework. Now, this causes an opportunity gap. And in order to close that opportunity gap, it is going to require access to high-speed internet. And that's why you're going to see this administration so very committed to this. And it's New York Times today had a comment that I think is really a little bit baffling. They said that infrastructure is fast becoming an afterthought. And I thought, are you kidding me? Not at all. This is kind of at the top of the heap. This is a president who is a builder, and he understands jobs growth, and he knows full well you're not going to achieve that if you don't have access to high-speed internet. And I will tell you also, his cabinet understands this. Secretary Ross, as they look at bringing back manufacturing, think about the needs for high-speed internet when you're talking about critical infrastructure and the protections that are going to be necessary there, the delivery systems that are necessary there, health, as we've mentioned, keeping these doors open at rural hospitals. It is an imperative. Agriculture with modern-day farming, whether it's planting, planning, irrigation, or harvesting. Utilization of high-speed internet, getting things ready to go to market, following those reports last week, RFD TV that does Morning Watch, which is kind of like the Bloomberg for the ag industry. They're headquartered right there in my district. I ran over and did Morning Watch with them. You have a lot of small farmers that look at it as big business in their life. And then, of course, you have educational opportunity. So meeting the imperatives are there, not only for the president, but for his cabinet, because they know that this is what is going to drive jobs It is going to drive access to better health care, and it's going to drive educational opportunity for all of our children and grandchildren. A couple of different things that are going to weigh on the overall issue that we're going to merge up and look at how we do this efficiently is how do you get barriers and red tape out of the way? This means how do you simplify siting, permitting? How do you make it easier for companies to want to participate? And then second is new dollars, investment. Where are they going to come from and where are they going to be going to? There was a Deloitte analysis, and I thought this was instructive. As you look at barriers, red tape, and funds, and then getting to what we want, which is an optimum utilization of spectrum that allows for broadband expansion. A Deloitte analysis said that the U.S. requires an investment of $130 to $150 billion in fiber infrastructure over the next 5 to 7 years in order to meet its needs. So that's a pretty hefty price tag. And it means that you're going to have to look at public-private partnerships, and you're going to need to look at local and state partnerships, and then coming in to the federal government. As you look at this investment, you also need to think in terms of wireless fiber and 5G and what that is going to mean. And as we write a broadband bill, the infrastructure bill, our focus is going to be on technology neutral, because we don't care if it is going to be wireline or fiber or fixed wireless or satellite, whatever. What we care is that you get the job done. And we also know that it's going to be important to look at leverage for the dollars that get invested. And as you look at public-private partnerships, as you look at local and state partnerships, then you come to the federal government to finish that money out and seek those grants. We fully realize that it is that we have some work to do, and we are currently moving forward with that. We've already had a hearing where we looked at mapping and some of the necessary items that need to be attended to in order to really set the right foundation for this to take place. I don't know about you. I think the FCC's 477 maps need a good scrubbing and need to be looked at. If you were to look at the map for Tennessee's 7th Congressional District, it would lead you to believe that 93% of the district has access to broadband internet, and I will tell you that is not so. And our states many times have done a much better job for their mapping and know where the needs are. So we're going to have a little bit of a revisit on that. I think there's also probably some a good, healthy conversation that needs to take place on what the speeds are. Do we need 15 down, 3 up? We need 25 down, 3 up. What should the speed be? And as you move into your panel discussion, you all will have the opportunity to dive a little deeper on those issues, because that's going to be an important part of the conversation. Now, as we look at the funding, rural America, the unserved areas is going to be the first focus. And there will be an emphasis on areas that are unserved. I spend a good bit of time on my weekends at farmers markets. And this past weekend, I was talking with a family. And they told me exactly where they lived, and they are they work, farmers doing the markets are a big part of their business model. And they said, this is where we live, and there's access to fiber that ends over here, and then there's wireline, and it ends over here, and we live right in here. And they're still on dial-up. They are still on dial-up. So think about that. They have four children that are all in elementary school. And they're running a small agribusiness all from their home, and they're on dial-up. So they're one of these families that get in the car and drive so that they can get a wireless signal. Regulatory burden is something that we're going to be reviewing. As you all know, the FCC is reviewing, too. What I have heard time and again from, doesn't matter if it's ILEX, CLEX, voice, video, data, whomever is providing a service, they all want certainty. And they would like for us to put some things in statute when it comes to net neutrality and dealing with some other issues so that it's not left to the rules of the FCC or the preferences of a commissioner. I will tell you, I do think that reclassifying broadband into Title II, which is a doorway to rate regulation and other components, has not been helpful. And I will remind you that in 2015, we had encouraged our colleagues to work with us in a bipartisan way so that we could put some things in statute and draw some bright lines on issues that would have prohibited the need, or as the commission thought it was a need, to move to Title II. So you can expect us to do a revisit on some of those issues. Chairman Walden, and I fully hope this is not a one-sided conversation. We hope that this is going to be a bipartisan conversation, bipartisan legislation as we move forward on these technology issues. I will just highlight with you that we do have an FCC oversight hearing tomorrow. As many of you are aware, the first FCC oversight hearing was scheduled back in March, but it happened to be scheduled on a day that the chairman needed us at the last minute to give him that day, and we marked up a health care bill, the AHCA markup. So we lost that hearing. This has been the first chance we've had to get everybody back together. And we will do the hearing tomorrow. We will also look at our FCC reauthorization bill during the course of that hearing. I encourage you to stay in touch with me. You all know where to find me on Facebook, Twitter. Chuck Flint, who leads our work on tech policy, is here with me today. You can easily find him also. Robin Caldwell is there at the committee and leads our team at the committee subcommittee staff. We have other issues in addition to broadband, all of which are going to have an impact. As I said, net neutrality will be covering this year. We're diving into some other things also, and you can expect legislation coming forward as we come back in September. NextGen 911. And those efforts are being led by Susan Brooks, Media Ownership, and Billy Long is leading the work we're doing there. Encryption, which Leonard Lance and Mimi Walters are leading that work. Privacy is being led by Bill Flores and Pete Olson. And as I said, tomorrow we'll look at the FCC reauthorization, and shortly after we will look at the NTIA reauthorization. I am so thrilled to join you, Nicole. Thanks for the invitation to be here. I thank you all. You're going to have a great panel, and we will look forward to hearing some of your thoughts that come from that panel. And be in touch, and let's make certain that we can expand broadband and get America back to work, healthy, and kids having access to education. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. So now we're going to go into the commentary side of this, which is to have the panelists talk through what they heard, and then we'll ask some other questions of them. So let me introduce them in the order that they will be sitting. I put my glasses on for that. Let me first introduce Jonathan Adelstein, who is the president and CEO of the Wireless Infrastructure Association and a former commissioner at the FCC. And I'll reserve my personal stories for each and every one of you so that it doesn't land up on Twitter or Facebook. Come on up, Jonathan. You're going to sit next to me. Yeah, exactly. I'll keep you in line. Next to Jonathan is actually go all the way down to that. I've got to follow directions right to the side. Go all down one more. Two more. Okay. Tell you. One more over. All my stuff is right there. Okay. You guys know I'm sitting over there. Okay. Rick Zimmerman, now you have to follow directions. You're going to get next to him, okay? Vice President of External State Affairs for NCTA, the Internet and Television Association, is joining us. And I have a history with him, but I'll reserve my thoughts. Brad Gillen, who is Executive Vice President of CTIA, the Wireless Association. And Brad, I'm going to keep it going. I won't say nothing about you either. And then last but not least, my friend here, David Goldman, who's Chief Telecom Counsel at the Office of Congressman Frank Pallone, is a ranking member of the House ENC Committee. Let's give them all a round of applause. That I have a pretty big mouth, so I'm going to sit here so we can have a nice conversation together. So let's talk about what we actually heard from the representative when it came to her thoughts on the infrastructure plan. I'd like for all of you just to give us a couple of minutes of commentary, reaction on what did we hear? What did we hear? David, I'll kind of start with you. We'll go down, and then I have a set of questions for you, but just general reaction to the congressman.
Hi. Well, first, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is great. So I'm just going to quickly, I wrote down what I heard as kind of what the plans were. Let me know if I'm missing anything. I heard that we have to talk about funding, streamlined siting, that things are going to be tech neutral. We should be looking at public-private partnership, mapping, thinking about mapping. We should have conversations about speeds, and we should be looking at unserved areas first. I think that's going through all of that, and maybe I missed something, but going through all that, that I was listening and thinking there's a lot there that we can have conversations about and a lot that we agree with. And then we got to regulatory burden and net neutrality, and not sure we're exactly in the same place on all of that. There was this screeching halt at that point. At least in that first part, when we're talking about the infrastructure pieces, I think that a lot of what Chairman Blackburn was saying, I think a lot of our members agree with and have done some work on this already, and we can talk about it more as we move on, but we have a number of bills that address a lot of these issues. We have bills that address the funding issues. We actually worked on a bipartisan bill last Congress on some of the siting issues, especially with federal lands. Tech neutrality, our work that we've been doing so far, we want to make sure we have speeds that are adequate and we don't create kind of two tiers of internet, but we're definitely focused on making sure that we're tech neutral. So what I heard was that there's a lot of place that we can start sitting down and working on it. Like I said, our members have put out a number of bills with their approach and what they're thinking about this. So we're looking forward to getting some engagement from the Republican side and starting to move forward on that.
I'll pick up on some of those bills and what they might be. Brad, general reaction to the congressman's remarks.
Thank you, Nicole. Thanks for having us. I think taking a step back, one of the most important things is we're having this session. A year ago when we started talking about infrastructure reform in this country, it was about roads and bridges and tunnels. And now it's assumed that broadband is part of that. And that's really a testament to Chairman Blackburn, to David and the Democrats as well, in a bipartisan fashion, saying if we're going to lead the world going forward, that broadband has to be central to that conversation. And that wasn't where we were a year ago. So I think the fact that we're talking about what different components that we have here is great progress. In our mind, it really is two challenges that have two separate sets of solutions. The first, as Chairman Blackburn talked about, her 16 and 19 rural counties and those Americans without access. We're very proud of the wireless industry to have spent $300 billion over the last 12 years to reach 99.6% of Americans. That's the people, not the country. And that we definitely want to work with Congress and the administration on how do you get every American and how do you close that digital divide, which does require, in most instances, government funding. These are uneconomic areas that we need help to serve. And that's certainly a key component of this. The other part of that Chairman Blackburn talked about was the regulatory red tape And what we're really looking for there is we're ready to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the next generation of wireless over the next decade, 5G, which we'll talk about more this afternoon, but it really goes to, we're going to build new networks. They're going to be fundamentally different in how they operate, and that's going to require a whole new set of infrastructure. Accenture looked at it, and this really translates to $275 billion will be invested by the wireless industry, not asking for any government money there, to build a whole new infrastructure on top of our world-leading 4G infrastructure. And that is going to create $500 billion added to the economy, 3 million new jobs. You know, about 10% of those, you know, Jonathan and company helped building the actual infrastructure and the construction jobs. But then, as the chairman addressed, it's going to touch every part of our community, agriculture, education, health, automotive. And it really will be transformative. And it's very important that we get the rules in place to allow us to start deploying today, because we're in a global race. That everyone sees what 4G wireless does for everyone in this room, what the apps economy happened here. Why? Because we have the best wireless industry. And you know, Japan, Korea, European Union, and China all want to take that for 5G. And the biggest thing the government can do to make sure we keep that lead is to allow us to have streamlined and modernized siting built for tomorrow's networks, and let us get start building.
Thanks, Nicole. I, too, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. So we heard much to agree with from Representative Blackburn, and I brought about 100 copies of something called Delivering Broadband to All Americans. I see some of you have it there in the audience. It looks like I didn't bring enough to go around, so feel free to contact me afterwards for a copy of that. But in there are six sort of principles, if you will, and I think that Congresswoman Blackburn touched on at least four of them. One is do a better job of mapping. Two is hit only or prioritize unserved over underserved or served areas. When I first walked in the green room, so to speak, my friend Jonathan Adelstein said, I know what you're going to say. You guys spent years beating me up at RUS about unserved versus underserved. And that's true. And I'm going to talk more about it later because it's vitally important to hit those that have nothing first. But also she talked about technology neutrality. So we're all here, obviously, to talk about broadband and getting broadband out to those that don't have it, to rural areas. But we shouldn't forget as we do that, and Brad talked a little bit about this, that broadband in America is largely a success story. So Congresswoman's 16 of 19 counties, you know, the FCC may not have it right that it's 93% served, but across America, cable alone is serving 85%+ with high speeds, 25 and 100 megabits or better, all driven through private investment. So although, you know, Brad expressed, I guess, pleasure that broadband is now part of the conversation, and we do too, we have to keep in our minds a distinction between the literally crumbling infrastructure, dams falling down, bridges falling down, roads filled with potholes, et cetera, that the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates has a $4.6 trillion unmet need, and those are infrastructure programs that are traditionally government funded, we have to distinguish between that and the largely private sector invested and built broadband networks. Now, having said that, since 2009 with BTOP and BIP and the FCC's universal service programs, the government has spent about $34 billion. We don't think that it has been all that effective because it hasn't been targeted at unserved versus underserved areas. So there is a role for government, but we should be clear that at the end of the day, this is largely going to be driven by the private sector because the government, in an era of limited resources, just doesn't have the money to go out and build what's necessary. And if we hearken back to the National Broadband Plan from 2010, it estimated at the time that to serve the last 7 million, this was at a time to get them to 4 megabits, so obviously we're way beyond that in terms of what we want, that it would cost $24 billion, but that to serve the last 250,000, out of that $24 billion, it would cost $14 billion. So that was 4% of what was defined as the problem, 4% of the 7 million. but that's 1/3 of 1% of the total. So to get that last 250,000 people, $14 billion, which is why one of our other principles is we have to rely on alternative technologies in some cases, whether it's satellite, fixed wireless, whatever it is. It's not just fiber and wireline to every home in America. So I will pause there, and then we'll come back and talk more about UNSERVED.
Yeah, and Jonathan, I want you to react, but I want, just for the clarification of the audience, to just sort of distinguish between UNSERVED and underserved, okay, so people kind of understand when we throw those terms around.
Sure, sure. Well, thanks for having me, Nicole, and thanks for being right next to you. You're I finally found where to go. And I think, you know, we found a good speaker today in our Chairman Blackburn. She really, I think, nailed it in terms of how to get this done, which is bipartisan, focus on jobs, focus on expanding broadband to rural America, and for all of the country to make sure that the siting rules are where they need to be. As Brad said, we work very closely with Brad and CTIA to try to get those rules changed in every state in the country. We're working on a state legislative campaign. CTIA has been a wonderful partner out there as we've gotten 11 states to pass laws in the last year and another state about to go. And we also need federal help. I mean, the fact is that this is interstate commerce. You know, this is squarely within the Commerce Committee's role to find a way to move the ball forward on investment. As my colleagues have said, we're prepared to invest, but if you throw roadblocks in front of it, it makes it more difficult. And the reason this is special is because it's broadband. I don't think if it was strip malls we're talking about, we'd have a full room here in terms of getting them zoned. But broadband has what here at Brookings we call externalities, where you have many economists. The benefits of broadband accrue to society to a much greater extent than just the benefits that accrue to those who provide it themselves. So you get the educational benefits that Congressman Blackburn talked about. You get the healthcare benefits that are so essential. And it transforms rural economies, as I learned at RUS. So we really have an opportunity here to do something great. And her emphasis on bipartisanship, I think, makes it more likely we'll get it done. I was glad to hear she didn't agree with the New York Times article. I woke up yesterday and read Afterthought. It wasn't very encouraging. But in the end, if you read the article, it wasn't as bad as the headline, because there's a lot of support in Congress and the administration on both sides in Congress, as we heard this morning from David Goldman, that folks want to get this done. And the committees in Congress aren't just talking about it, they're working on it. David talked about bills they're working on. Bills are happening on both sides of the aisle in both houses of Congress. So this is very actively under consideration. The White House is working on legislative language as well that includes broadband. So we have come a long way in saying that this is something that we're going to get done. For our industry, I think the streamlining is much more important than the dollars. And I think the dollars do need to be focused on areas where it's otherwise uneconomical. And you mentioned unserved versus underserved. It's a tricky kind of distinction to make, because they're it's not as simple, as I learned in doing this, to define where unserved begins and underserved ends, because the edges are very fuzzy. And we could go and probably spend the whole hour about the debate about how that gets done. It's hard to make something economical if it's unserved. That's why they're unserved, because there's not a market for it. And it's not just the market for getting it built, but then you have to have the OPEX covered, which the operating expenses sometimes aren't even economical. Even if you give somebody free broadband, there's nobody there to run it and make sure that it's sustainable. So generally speaking, Congress in 2009 permitted underserved areas to be covered in order to allow it to be economic. And without that, I think it would have been more difficult, actually, to get the resources out. But we could discuss that. I mean, that was my previous hat. Right now, as far as the wireless infrastructure industry, we're prepared to deploy the capital, not necessarily looking for federal help there, but much more important that we get the streamlining done to make it possible for the capital investment to flow quickly, to not have resistance. It's not just money that it costs, and time is more important in some ways. The delays are costly, and I think it's got to be a balance. You know, we're not talking about any delays. It's just unreasonable delays. Let's come up with a way of getting this process done so that it's a win-win. The community gets broadband. The industry is able to serve the consumers that are demanding it.
So I want to go back to this theme that I keep hearing, which is bipartisanship and bills, right? So, David, I'm going to come back to you for just a minute, because we heard from the chairwoman a lot of things about, you know, this should be bipartisanship. And let me just remind everybody, this is an infrastructure panel, not net neutrality panel today, so we can stay focused on the infrastructure side. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the Dems are actually doing when it comes to infrastructure that may lead us closer to being more bipartisan with this particular proposal?
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I guess, so our members from the beginning of this Congress have been stressing three themes within the telecom world, but I think it probably expands beyond that, which is security, opportunity, and that's where we are talking about jobs, and connectivity, making sure that everyone in the country is connected. Along those lines, we've rolled out a number of bills this Congress, but the one that I think is most appropriate for to talk about right now is the Lift America Act that we put out. And this is a bill that the Energy and Commerce Democrats put out to across the entire committee. So it deals with healthcare that we have in our committee. It deals with energy. But also the biggest part in the first section of the bill is broadband. And we set aside $40 billion to reach 98%. And that number is based off of FCC numbers that they put out and FCC predictions that it would cost about $40 billion to get about 98% of the country. Obviously, we want to get to 100, but I think we're starting there. And the way that we allocate it is most of it gets allocated through a reverse auction mechanism. We do prioritize unserved. I actually think that virtually everything you said that for cable's priorities, we probably hit. It's technology neutral. We acknowledge in rural areas we may not be able to get to the highest speeds. Most of the places we're trying to get to 100 megabits, we acknowledge we're not going to be able to get there everywhere. And then we take off a portion of it to also realize that not every state is going to have unserved, but that every state does have infrastructure problems. And so we take a portion of it and we allocate it across the states to run their own reverse auctions. And that's when they can start looking at some of these underserved areas. They can also look at fixing things like school broadband, 911, next generation 911. So that's the Lift America Act. But we really kind of have a suite of bills we've been pushing out that try to address these issues. Because the truth is that broadband, it is a rural problem. It's also an urban problem. It's also a number of other issues that we need to be paying attention to. And they all need to be looked at together. So I just wanted to quickly run through a couple of the other bills. Congressman Lobsack has a bill that does look specifically at the data and asks the FCC to improve its wireless data. This is something, and I think we heard Chairman Blackburn say it earlier, that this is something that I've worked both at the FCC and in Congress. This is an issue that the members of Congress know better than the people at the FCC, to be totally honest with you. They drive every corner of their district. They know every corner of it. They know what's served. They know what's not served. They know where they get dropped calls. They know when they go to community center and everyone there says we're not connected. And then when they're brought the FCC maps and it says, don't worry, it's all covered, they know that that's not serious. Congressman Lobsack is pushing this bill. I don't want to get ahead of him. I know he's working to try to find a Republican co-sponsor to work with him on that. We're hopeful that that becomes a bipartisan bill and that we can start moving on that. Congressman Ruiz has a bill where he actually looks at helping to subsidize tribal areas. Something that gets, I think, left out in these conversations a lot is what are we going to do for tribes? They're horribly underserved. It's really not economic to get there, and you really need to have some government intervention to help out. Congressman Welch looks at schools. He's got a bill that addresses making sure that there's Wi-Fi in schools the way we need it. Congressman Lujan is working on a bill that addresses public-private partnerships, and this one has not come out yet, but one of the things he's looking at is can we help cities, municipalities, and this addresses kind of the urban issue, so can we help some of these places build out some of their own fiber and then be able to partner with carriers, with the people who can run it? We're looking a lot at what about these municipalities who don't want to run their own systems. They want to find partners there, but it's not economic to go and start digging up the streets for the companies themselves. Can we help the city make it financially beneficial for everybody? So that's a bill that he's working on, and we hope to get that out soon. And last, I just want to plug another bill. It's not straight on broadband, but we just rolled out last week what we call the Viewer Protection Act that looks at making sure that there's enough funding for broadcast towers and the repack that's happening, and from the incentive auction. So that's making, we're just, you don't want to forget that there's communication takes a number of forms. There's wireline, there's wireless, but it also goes over the air on broadcast. And so we're trying to pay attention to that as well. At the same time, trying to balance making sure that the spectrum that came out of the incentive auction gets out to the mobile carriers as fast as possible. So those are the bills that we're working on with ECA. I think that's it.
Yeah, no, these are great. I mean, if you haven't, and David, these are all on public record, or they're being percolated, or how?
The Lujan bill is coming soon, but okay. The rest of them, they're all out. They've all been introduced.
So. Okay, so, you know, what I want to do next is tease out, I want to get to the money part, right? But I would like to tease out this urban-rural dynamic that appears in the infrastructure plan, right? And so there's been a lot of discussion when people talk about the infrastructure proposals that most of the money will go into rural, or most of the incentives will go into rural, et cetera. I'd like to hear from the varying industries what that looks like. Should it be one or the other, an urban play, a rural play, a combination of both? How do you see what the chairwoman was sort of laying out affecting, I mean, she's obviously Tennessee, right? But affecting all of the infrastructure needs that actually exist across the country. Brad, you want to start?
Sure, and I think it has to be all of the above. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely the underserved areas, and a lot of what David touched on is those communities where we're going to need government's help to get there, and there's we can have a conversation about how to do that. But you know, our macro right now is focusing on how do we upgrade our networks throughout the country, rural, urban, and suburban, and what does that look like? If you think about it, we've had a set of government rules at every level of government, federal, state, local, FCC, to build a community of 200-foot towers you see along the highway. And that has, we lead the world in that. Now we're looking to towers smaller than this. And when you start talking about small cells and what we're going to need to do, the rules aren't designed for that at any level of government. And so that's what we're looking to do, is to have rules that actually promote the kind of deployments we want to make to lead the world. And that is something, as Nicole alluded to, it's got to be everywhere. This has got to be the town squares of every, you know, Manhattan, Kansas, and Manhattan, New York. And that goes to access. If you think about where these things are going to go, access is key. It's going to be on streetlights. It's going to be on telephone poles. This is a much more discreet technology. It's about timing. What is the process to do this? It's one thing to have layers of regulation and requirements for a 250 tower in your community. If you're putting up hundreds of thousands of these, it's a very different process, and we need the certainty to know that we can build and that we get an up or down answer, and the rest, it goes to cost. And that is the cost. Does the cost reflect the technology, and does it reflect the discreteness of our of what we're trying to build? So in terms for us to be able to get to every pocket of the country, it really, the focus for us is on that streamlining process.
Hey, Jonathan, I'm going to go to you, and then I'm going to go to Rick, since you guys are in the same industry vertical, obviously.
Right.
Same approach in terms of small cell deployment. What are you looking at?
Well, yeah, I mean, Brad's right about maybe to step back and look at the network architecture that he's referring to is 5G's densification. So we have limited amount of spectrum. We're trying to get more spectrum out of government, but it's like, you know, you look at so much blood out of a turnip, and it's been too slow, too little, and not enough is lined up, as CTIA has pointed out very clearly. So what's really done the lion's share of work in the past and what is going to in the future to provide the data throughput that's necessary for wireless is raw strength of more infrastructure, just building more of it. And that involves densification, means putting more and more sites closer and closer to the end user. That means towers themselves get filled up because carriers are going on towers that might not be on. It might be AT&T's on one, and now T-Mobile's going to add itself to that one. So they're getting filled up. And in rural areas, towers tend to be much more cost-effective. Small cells tend to be more expensive. The little ones that he talked about is not necessarily cost-effective in a rural area. Generally speaking, small cells fill in the network for capacity issues. What's happened is the towers aren't going away. They're going to remain there to provide the umbrella coverage. But there's so much demand for data, which is predicted to go up another 600% over the next 5 years, that they're falling short of keeping up with the demand for data, particularly if you have kids, you see how much video they watch.
Right.
It's just sucking up enormous amounts of bandwidth. So to keep up with that, industry's investing particularly in urban areas and suburban to begin with, in densifying with small cells as well as putting more equipment on the towers. In rural areas, it's not necessarily cost effective to do that because it's generally more expensive per megabit than a tower would be. And so the interesting issue here is that regulatory relief I think probably will do more good in urban suburban than in rural, where rural we're just starving for investment. It's more of an economic issue than a permitting, although there are permitting issues in many rural areas, particularly some of the higher end areas where the NIMBYs are strong and they say, don't put that tower in my beautiful, you know, $3 million estate's backyard. And of course, that's always a handful of NIMBYs, just as is everywhere else. It's not the majority of people. And the rest of them complain they can't get the service they need, but the capital will end up going somewhere else if folks are throwing up barriers. So in rural areas, if they throw up barriers, forget about it. It's game over. So you have to assume that you have good regulatory treatment in a rural area. They're not going to get the investment. In urban areas, it tends to be the same thing to some extent. If they throw up barriers, then the capital tends to flow somewhere else, depending on how dense it is. So the areas that complain the most end up hurting their citizens the most profoundly and denying their own citizens the access to the healthcare and the educational benefits that Marsha Blackburn talked about. And I guess why Chairman Blackburn and Ranking Member Pallone and on a bipartisan basis, we're hearing so much agreement. And what I heard really today was an agreement on the big issues about the need for getting this job done. It's really encouraging, I think, that there's a recognition that broadband is something of a national treasure, that we have to get it out. It's important to the entire nation that everybody have access to this. And so creating, I think, certainty that we've talked about and regulatory streamlining is crucial to getting it done.
So, Rick, what about you in terms of urban, rural, and the cable industry's perspective? And then I want to go into a conversation on money.
Sure. So let me just start by saying, you know, I certainly agree with what Brad and Jonathan have said, but that I just want to make a sort of an overarching point that we can't forget, which is that wireless is only the last few feet, if you will, few hundred feet, whatever, of broadband. Everything else goes through the wired network, comes in through the tower, goes in through the pole. You know, there might be some microwave or something, but your wireless is really built on wireline. And therefore, when we're talking about streamlining and removing barriers to deployment, we can't forget the wireline side of it. You know, my friends on either side of me have done a fantastic job in Congress and in the states pitching their message, and maybe we haven't done that good a job. But also we haven't been looking for as much relief. We do have some specific proposals that we can get into on what Congress should do with respect to removing barriers to deployment on the wireline side. But we can't forget that. And I have to say one thing that might disturb Brad more than Jonathan, I don't know. Unlicensed. Now, CTIA supports unlicensed too, but unlicensed spectrum, when we think about unlicensed, think about Wi-Fi. Okay? So here's a couple stats. All data out there today, 52% is carried over wireline networks from the endpoint. That means 48% is over wireless. Well, of that, this is for data, of that, 45% of the total, meaning over 90% is carried over Wi-Fi, and only 3% of the larger data question goes over licensed mobile spectrum. So over 90% of all wireless data goes over Wi-Fi. So just think about that in your home. The average home has, you know, 11 or more Wi-Fi connected devices. You might have one device plugged in, you know, the one desktop computer or something that's plugged into the cable modem or the, you know, the Verizon product or whatever it is. But every other device, I have three kids, the oldest of which is 12. I'm not going to go through. Sometimes I do a slide of all the devices. We're over 22 connected devices in the home between the game consoles, the iPods, the other things. And, you know, I'm just the average American consumer here. It's not like we have, you know, crazy spoiled kids. So the point is, you know, Wi-Fi, we can't forget about unlicensed. But I want to come back to unserved for a moment and give an analogy, which goes to the urban-rural question. And it's this. I mean, I assume that most or all of you have been to a wedding or been to a bar mitzvah or been to a conference where they're serving the meal as a buffet, right? So you can look at me and say that when it comes to buffets, I'm rarely underserved. So the point is, you know, once I've gotten my plate and I've gone and eaten, I don't go back in the line until all those little old ladies and all the kids and everyone else has gone through the line. Well, that's what it's like, unserved versus underserved. Underserved has something already. And the problem has been with our universal service program, every time they raise the speeds, Well, it's a lot easier to serve those people that are already served. So that's where the money goes. When they went from 4 to 10 that they're funding now, some people that already have something are getting more. And no one ever goes to the people that have nothing. Those are the people that haven't made it through the buffet line at all. And that's who we need to prioritize and get them something before we worry about giving the people like me that have already eaten a second plate and a bigger helping.
Well, let me go to the buffet analogy now. I'm going to just put it out as a disclaimer. I don't like buffets because I don't eat enough at the buffet to make it worth my while. But let me ask about this whole investment piece, though, right? Because if we just stay on Rick's analogy with the buffet, we've got this distribution of wealth or distribution of assets or food that's hitting, you know, pretty much the ecosystem. There is this assumption in the infrastructure plan that there'll be some private investment, and the chairwoman said we need money. Where does it come from? Because obviously the people who are eating little bits aren't getting the attention to actually go into the marketplace and invest. And that will obviously be an issue with the infrastructure plan.
The unserved areas will need government money. There's no question about it. And I think Jonathan made the point, you know, they're not economic in the first place. That's why people haven't gone there. So, you know, we fully acknowledge government money will be necessary in many of those, if not all of those places.
So, I can't resist the buffet analogy real quick. Speaking my personal hat, but not necessarily my job, but sometimes if you get a buffet, you see these little buffets at some Indian restaurant, hardly anybody goes through it. And you wonder, how's that economic? How do you finance having all that wonderful food out there and only 3 people are coming through? And that's the problem with serving unserved only, is that where are you going to get the basic infrastructure for the buffet so that if everybody's sharing it, then you get the economics work a lot better? That was what I learned at RUS. If you just have unserved only is where the money should be focused on to the extent possible. But generally speaking, the way that broadband networks work is that they broad networks. They go over a large area, and they don't just serve one little area. And you can't get a business to set up just to serve unserved only. So you end up funding a business that serves a broader area. Hopefully, you cover the unserved, but often there's going to be other areas that are underserved or even served as part of that. It's just not that neat. And otherwise, it's very hard if you're doing a subsidy to get solely unserved, because then even it's hard to cover the OPEX. I think it's the right focus is trying to get unserved dealt with. But how you do that is messy. And that's why I guess maybe the restaurant business is tougher than wireless even.
Yeah, so a couple of points. First, you should have let the little old ladies ahead of you in the buffet. Anyway. I mean, seriously. We got a sick Costanza problem here. Second, you make me do a lot of math. So 50% of broadband is 90% Wi-Fi. Is that? I'm just kidding. I'm with you on that one. But one of the things to talk about that we thought about when we were putting together our infrastructure bill that has this $40 billion is realize that if we're going to do a big infrastructure package like this, this is different than we have a number of other subsidy programs that are out there, and they all have to work together. This is something that we've been talking about on our side is starting to think about how do we make sure that all these different programs are coordinating with each other? Because it's not, there's RUS, which is great. There's the Universal Service Program at the FCC. But there's a number of other ones throughout the government, Department of Commerce and other places. How are we making sure that these all work together? Because if we do a big infrastructure plan that has money, that tries to reach out to these areas, that's going to be a one-time investment most likely. And what we don't want to do is strand that investment. What we don't want to do is pay for fiber to be laid or towers to be built. And because it's not economic to serve that area, we're just stranding that infrastructure there. And that's why we need to think about not only having this one-time infrastructure spend, but how do we think about using these other subsidy programs like Universal Service to keep those things going, to keep the operating expenses going on after that. So I think one of the things to think about as we're doing this is that there's different pieces, and they all have to fit together, and we shouldn't be just doing complete shotgun approach on this of let's just do all of them without thinking about it and hope that it all works out for the best. I think we have an opportunity now to plan ahead for if we do have a big infrastructure spend, what happens to the Universal Service Program from that after that? What happens to RUS? How are we using that? How are we maximizing those? And do we have someone in government who is in charge going forward to think about these different programs that are across these different agencies and how they all work together?
Yeah, and I want to pick up, Brett, I want to go to you just on this question. In a few minutes, if you have any questions, please start preparing them because we'll open it up and obviously tweet U.S. Broadband so we can continue this conversation after this. You know, there's been a lot of conversation. I think David is right. There's going to be this mix of subsidies. There's going to be this mix of private investment in some way the industries that you all work in has already been putting millions and billions of dollars actually in infrastructure build. What about these regulatory incentives? Like, if you were to do this pendulum of what's more important, is it the incentives that were discussed in terms of some regulatory compassion, or is it the money, right? Or is it what Jonathan said, maybe the money, but in these areas? So I'd like to get a sense, just, you know, in terms of the industry, where would you like to see these prioritized? Because obviously we want to get to bipartisan consensus on this.
Sure. And I think for us, it really, I think the money is about the rural challenge. That's where the money goes. If you're looking at how do we get next generation facilities out there, it is about removing the impediments. And I completely agree with you. We need more fiber. None of this happens without fiber. And then we need to make sure dig once and other policies are in place too. And again, not a very fun panel, but I also agree we need more unlicensed as well. But we need both. For us to lead the world in wireless going forward, every application is going to have its own solution. If a connected car has hundreds of sensors and HD cameras, what is the right technology mix to make that go? What kind of network are you going to need to do that? And we're going to need all of these things. And in terms of the money, it truly is. You know, we're ready to spend, Extensa projects, $275 billion of our own money to get this right. And I know the cable industry expends billions of dollars every year too. And so it really is for us is how do you enable and unlock that private investment at every level of government to let us go build?
Right, it's the same thing for the cable. Same thing for the cable industry in terms of priority, money, incentive, or something else?
You know, so as a general matter, we are not...
Yeah, turn on your mic.
As a general matter, we are not looking for government money. So streamlining would be a higher priority. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that in terms of rural broadband that it's not important to spend money. You know, those uneconomic places where even, you know, we're not really changing the incentives probably, and it may just be that the government has to fund those places. So that's fine. But in terms of, you know, what we're looking for to either expand our footprint, to raise our speeds, to do things like that, that has more to do with the streamlining side of the equation. And I have been very remiss in not mentioning pole attachments because pole attachments are a huge impediment. Pole attachment costs and fees and practices and procedures at all levels of getting more fiber and more deployment. And, you know, I know that my colleagues also are working with pole owners in many places. That includes municipalities, co-ops, investor-owned utilities. But pole attachment reform is something that we'd like to see in either at the FCC or in any infrastructure bill.
I'm going to ask you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I got to agree with them. I think the industry as a whole is looking for regulatory relief to deal with the bulk of this. I mean, the thing you have to realize is that it's not as easy as it looks to build 5G networks. It's extremely expensive, and the revenue is not necessarily going to cover the costs of a number of carriers and other players, perhaps even the cable industry, building out 5G networks. The consumers are getting a great deal. You know, you've got prices dropping 13% in the last year, and yet all these unlimited plans are coming out. Consumers are using more and more data. So consumers are getting more for less, and who's left holding the bag? But really the industry that's doing these investments to keep up with all that, they're spending enormous amounts of money while the average revenue per user goes down, while margins get tighter, while prices go down. At some point, the government can't keep throwing roadblocks up in the way of that and expect that the demand of the consumers is going to get met. And particularly in an area so important to the overall economy and healthcare, education, et cetera, as broadband, we've got to get some relief and some certainty about the rules in order to build out this whole new architecture I talked about of densification. That means make it easier to get on towers too. And Congress has already done that on a bipartisan basis. They enacted a law to make it easier to co-locate on an existing facility. And we've got to continue that progress. And I think that's why we really look to the regulatory package as the most important part.
Question, it wasn't one I was going to pose to you all, but I do have a question as my portfolio handles digital inclusion. You know, at the end of the day, I mean, the bigger question is if rural is still going to be a problem today, even with this infrastructure plan, it still sounds like it's going to still be a problem, right? In tribal communities. I mean, how do we actually solve that? Will the infrastructure plan alone be something that could actually address the digital divide? Or is it going to have to be other things that are actually going to have to address the digital divide to be more conscious about closing it?
So it's going to be other things. I mean, let's think about just the plain old voice telephone, okay. Right? I mean, even today we're at maybe 98% and we still have a percent or two of folks that don't have electricity. Now, maybe some people choose to live off the grid. But the point is, even after, you know, 60 years, however many years of trying to get phone service out to everyone, we haven't done it. So I think although it's an admirable goal of 100% for broadband, we also have to be realistic. But having said that, let's harken back to the National Broadband Plan. And, you know, Nicole, you and I have been working, you much harder than I, on adoption and digital inclusion for years. But in the National Broadband Plan, Blair Levin, the primary author, used to go around saying, look, you know, we can work on the 7% problem. That's what we've been talking about here today, the 7% that don't have broadband. Or we can work on the 30% problem, which is those people to whom broadband is available but choose not to subscribe for any number of reasons. It might be digital literacy. It might be cost issues. It might be lack of equipment, whatever it is. But, you know, we should also be realistic and say, all right, you know, 7% problem. We're going to work on that quite a bit. We're going to throw money at it. We're going to do things. But there's this other, in some ways, bigger problem that really doesn't get all of the attention. And so it is going to take much more than just the infrastructure plan to deal with closing the digital divide.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's something, as this conversation is actually going on, that we might think about some of those things, because if not, we talk about the same thing. I want to get to questions, but I do have one more burning question I do have to ask. So we've talked about, you know, what could go into the proposal. I do have to ask this, and I'm not going to say what industry I was talking to, but I was asked an interesting question when it came up to, well, you know, we do have the private investment to do all this stuff. Intelligent infrastructure, though. So I'm from New York City, and I would like to know that the George Washington Bridge has some broadband and a sensor as I'm driving over it that somebody is watching.
That's when the bridge is open.
Right, when it's open. But I'm thinking, and I think many of us in this audience, when we think about AI and we think about connected cars and we begin to think about sensors and the placement of sensors, et cetera, why is it that broadband is actually not integrated into the conversation of crumbling roads and bridges? Wouldn't it make sense to actually figure out how do you run a broadband connection alongside the bridge or alongside the dam or whatever the case may be so we can avert disasters? Anybody working on anything like that?
Absolutely. I think there is a lot of effort right now to figure out what those partnerships look like. I see Donna out there working with Sacramento and doing a lot of new things to get both fiber out there, but also to get other services out there that you see other places working in San Diego and others where you're seeing streetlights that are part connected, that I think we really have to get to a place, if it has power, it needs connectivity, and that we need to give cities the tools to better manage their roads, to better manage their every other part of water, power, energy, that I definitely think those conversations are happening in earnest. And those really need to be partnerships. And so when we go to cities to talk about how deploying new networks, part of that is how can we help you run your city better by giving you access to more information, by giving your residents access to more information. But you're exactly right. If you're building a new road, if you're going to build new pipeline, if you're ripping up the streets, broadband connectivity with fiber, wireless, all of this needs to be part of that for the city to benefit from where we need to go.
Yeah, I think the idea of smart cities requires smart regulation. They're not going to get that kind of connectivity unless they basically roll out the red carpet and allow providers to come in and get it covered everywhere. You think about a connected car uses more data than all of Rick's kids and their 22 devices combined. One car driving down the road, a lot more data. It's remarkable how much data. So to build that dense of a network is an enormous commitment of capital. And if along the way you can't have a spot where somebody complained they don't want the antenna in their backyard, which happens to be near a street where there's a lot of traffic, and all of a sudden you have a hole in the network, we got to have this ubiquitous network. So that's why the federal government, I think, is stepping in, and Chairman Blackburn and the Democrats and the administration are all thinking about how are we going to make this, if you're going to have it smart devices, they really have to have that universal coverage and very deep into the network.
David?
Well, now I don't want to give them the opportunity to rebut me now.
Whatever Rick's going to say, he's wrong. this is my pre-buttal. No, so we've worked on a couple of things. So Congresswoman Eshoo from our committee has worked in a bipartisan way on a policy called Dig Once, which basically means when you're digging up the street, when you're building these other things, put the broadband conduit in when you're doing it then. So that way, Rick's members can start laying their fiber. it's just, it's an easy thing to do, and it's something we should be doing anyway. Something that we added into our Lift America Act, so that's in our infrastructure bill that we did this year, is maybe a new step on the dig once, which is, as we're starting to lay these conduits, you should also be putting access points in, because we're going to have smart cars, we're going to have smart infrastructure, we're building out these cities, but also along highways, we're going to want to be able to connect Jonathan's Towers so Brad's guys can all get into it really quickly. And what's bad now is a lot of times when we run this fiber along highways, the access points will be 10 miles apart. And it doesn't, for that 10 miles in the middle, you have fiber there and you can't get into it. So think about it ahead of time. When we're laying this fiber, let's start making it easy to start cutting into it, so that way, as we're upgrading the other infrastructure and making everything smart, that we have an easy way in. So I think there's things, that we can start thinking about now to start building out towards that.
So I will agree with everything that David said. I just wanted to make my one net neutrality point that I heard from somewhere else, which is, no, it's, yeah, okay, all right. No, all right. You can't have smart cities with dumb pipes, all right? So I think that's a bumper sticker. You can't have smart cities with dumb pipes. But having said that,
and I just
things.
Closed up all those conduits.
Yes.
Just so you know.
This panel is getting out of control.
there is some work in Washington. The Bipartisan Policy Something Center, and I'm forgetting the name, has done some work, a lot of work on infrastructure over the years, but specifically on these questions that you're raising. And they did something back in May with the U.S. Chamber infrastructure folks on that very topic.
Yeah, I mean, this is all a very interesting topic. I want to open it up for any questions that anyone may have. If you could raise your hand, I'll ask as you ask your question so we can get all of you in before we close out the panel. Just keep your comments short as we get to the last two questions. I might ask you to both say your questions and then have the panelists respond, so stay alert. Let's start with this gentleman right here.
I want to thank the panel for a very good presentation. My name is Elliot Hurwitz. I'm a former State Department official and intelligence community person. Representative Blackburn said that this administration is committed to infrastructure. And she quoted the New York Times article as saying that infrastructure is becoming a backwater. I think infrastructure is becoming a backwater. And I know the title of this is Including Broadband in Trump's Infrastructure Program, but Trump's infrastructure program is the last thing on his list of priorities. I mean, he's talking about immigration, he's talking about health care, he's talking about legal reforms, he's talking about immigration, he's talking about Russia, he's talking about all kinds of things. Infrastructure scarcely ever gets mentioned. Would anyone like to comment on that, please?
Don't all speak at once.
Sure. I think we heard Chairman Blackburn said it's her priority, Commerce Secretary Ross's priority. I think this is really what is the opportunity to move this issue forward. And the infrastructure package is certainly one of them and a central one of them. But as we've alluded to, there's lots of other places that this conversation's happening at the FCC and localities and states to move this forward. And we're going to need all of those things. So from our perspective, it really is anyone talking about how do we get more broadband out there, how do we streamline those processes, is an important conversation for us to be part of.
One thing, just you know, it's clear looking at the title that we're talking about broadband and infrastructure, and you've asked the question about is the big thing moving,
right,
which is a great question, and very unclear to a lot of different people. You read the New York Times article and you can see different perspectives on it. But one thing that we have gotten broad bipartisan agreement on, and within the administration, within Democrats in Congress, as we heard today from David Goldman, Republicans, we heard from Chairman Blackburn, is that broadband is going to be included. So if something moves, we're like a passenger on a ship, and if something moves, it's going to have broadband in it. It's going to have regulatory relief as a function of that. And the shape of that is something that we're discussing right now. And I've talked to the people at the White House who are working on it today. So there is work going on the details of broadband being included in the package. So, you know, we're subject to the big movement of it. I hope it goes. And if it does, I know we're going to be on the boat. So that's good.
Right. And here at Brookings, we are nonpartisan. I would say if he started with infrastructure, we might have a different headline.
And
today.
Nicole, just to follow up, just as I was remiss in not talking about pole attachments, I've been remiss really in not talking about the FCC, although that's not the subject of this panel. You know, I mentioned them tangentially earlier, but we shouldn't forget that they have a huge role and there are things they can do without additional congressional authorization. And they have before them today, first of all, they created the Broadband Deployment Advisory Committee, of which Jonathan is a part, and we have various representatives on there. They have a wireline infrastructure proceeding, a wireless infrastructure proceeding, a petition before them, and I'm highly confident that they will do some things in this space that we have been talking about in terms of streamlining. They can't necessarily create more money. I suppose they could raise universal service funds, but having said that, you know, one of our points, I'm sorry, in our paper is the FCC should be quarterbacking these support programs. They should largely be the primary quarterback.
David?
And so I just want to add, I get your point about the administration, but...
He's still answering your question, Ellie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're trying.
We can talk later if you want. No, I was just going to say, just ultimately remember that this package, Congress is going to have to do the heavy lifting on this. Yep. So I'd say don't let Congress off the hook. Mm-hmm. Keep pressuring Congress to do this. Yep. This is why we have been putting these bills out here, is because we want to be working on it. We want to be thinking about these issues. The worst thing that can happen, the worst way for this to be done, is at some point there's an announcement we're doing an infrastructure bill and it's going to be done by the end of the month and we throw something together that no one thought about. So I think now is the time to be doing the heavy lifting and trying to think about these issues, which is what we're trying to do. But regardless of what the president is saying, talk to your members of Congress and tell them that this is something they should be doing, because ultimately that's who's going to be doing the work on it.
That's right. Second question, just to make sure we move along, go over here. And if you can keep your question real brief, and panelists, if you can keep your response real brief, we'll be able to get a couple more questions in. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for coming here and talking about this very important topic. My name is Gavin Logan, and I am with the National Urban League. A lot of the stuff that you all have been talking about is incredibly important and right on point. One of the things that I did not hear mentioned, and I was wondering if you have had a chance to think about, is not just when we talk about diversity in terms of users, but also supply line diversity. With any infrastructure particularly, there's going to be a lot of contracting, subcontractors. As you all mentioned, a lot of this is going to be driven by the private sector. And one of the things that we at the Urban League are concerned about or hopeful of is that there will be areas, opportunities in diversity as well in the supply line as well. Have you all had a chance to think about that? And if you could provide any off-the-cuff remarks if you haven't.
We've done a lot of work on that. As a matter of fact, the Wireless Infrastructure Association has pioneered a diversity summit at our annual show, where we bring diverse suppliers together with the large companies, AT&T and T-Mobile and Verizon and American Tower and Crown Castle and SBA, all these large communications putting out contracts to basically do matchmaking and try to diversify that pipeline. And we've actually worked with NUL as well and MMTC on getting training out in to a diverse population to make sure that the people that are working on America's broadband networks look like those who are using them.
Anybody else? Next question was over here. Okay.
Hey, thanks all for coming. This is a question for David and then perhaps Jonathan, being part of the BDAC, which is fun to say. Well, anyone who wants to address it, the Congresswoman talked about, Chairman Blackburn talked about Form 477, and we all have noted the bipartisan agreement around getting accurate data for informing coverage maps as they are now, or where coverage is, but what about, can you speak to concerns about accountability for companies who receive public monies to then say, okay, well, we've delivered our payload, so to speak, or we've made our deliverable on the back end? And if you can speak specifically to the Gigabit Opportunity Act that the BDAC is working on codes to inform, that'd be good as well. Thank you.
I think that's a really important issue. So I guess there was a couple things in there. One of the things I know that the FCC is considering right now that we're watching is there's the accuracy of the data, and it's It's also how do you challenge it going forward to make sure that it's right? And I know CTIA has proposals on how to do that. So that's one of the things we're watching closely of how to make sure that that's done in a way that going forward we're making sure that the money is spent correctly, and that going forward we're making sure the maps continue to be accurate. So I think that's right. I also think on any of these infrastructure bills, it's something, and I don't know that there's a resolution on this yet, but it's one of the things we've been talking a lot about is if we're going to spend all this money, who's monitoring it? And how are we making sure that it's getting spent in the right way? And I don't think it's just enough to kind of claw back what's left after you've misspent it. So it's one of the things we're looking very closely at, that of making sure that whatever mechanisms that we use to spend the money has an accountability to it and has proper oversight. There's been history in some of the programs at the FCC not to have that. And so we don't want to recreate that, especially if we're going to put the amount of money that we've been talking about putting in there. So I think there's a little bit of a stay tuned, but it's something that we're paying very close attention to.
And I'm just going to jump in real quick on that point because we presciently had that in our paper that I was distributed. I mentioned there were 6 points. Number six, you practically just read it. Demand accountability in spending public monies to ensure that subsidies achieve their intended results. We've got a whole paragraph on it, a citation to Inspector General reports, several of them professing concern about the spending of money. But it's exactly one of our six key points, demand accountability. And once again, I'm happy to hear David agree with me.
I'm going to end with one last question. John, we'll take you.
Hi, John Piha, Carnegie Mellon University. I've heard a number of times today that to do unserved ahead of underserved, but we struggled in the BTOP and BIP days with defining unserved and underserved, and often underserved means a census block or a city or a county where some people have great broadband and some households have nothing, and I'm wondering if they're going to get left behind. So to those who say unserved ahead of underserved, can you tell me exactly what you mean by unserved and underserved?
Well, one of the problems with BIP and BTOP is that they didn't do number one on our list, which is do the maps first. So there's problems with 477. Yes, it's problems with census blocks. There are many proposals. Chairman Blackburn held a hearing on mapping where she heard several different proposals to do a better job at the FCC. We've recommended, I think, giving more money to the FCC to refine their data. We think it's pretty easy to tell who's unserved, the people that have nothing. Is there going to be some overlap? Yes. Our problem with BIP and BTOP in particular was it was clear, the definition was if there's only 25% unserved, we had suggested 75% as the law. So we had vast areas of Kansas, for example, where there's an existing employee-owned provider where someone came in, they got either BIP or BTOP money, I forget which, they completely overbuilt the existing provider and essentially did nothing for the unserved. So is it a problem? Yes. But nonetheless, I think we can still prioritize those that haven't made it through the buffet line at the beginning before giving other people something better.
And it is tough to define, having lived through that. I guess going back to history, going to the 477, Rick brought back some old memories, I guess maybe because I'm old, we shouldn't have done the maps first back in 2009. And Congress actually authorized the maps in the same bill that they authorized these programs and talked about unserved versus served. And what's interesting is that here we are 8 years later saying the maps are still wrong. So if we'd done what Rick had said and said done the maps first, they still wouldn't be any good. And we still would have had to go out there and do the kind of analysis we did on a granular basis. Each time we looked at it, we asked the provider to lay out exactly what was happening in the community. We tried to cross-reference that. We opened up to the public to complain or say that there's inaccuracies in their analysis of what's served and unserved. So we had to go through a very granular process at the time. What people forget is at the time we had high unemployment, 10%, the economy was cratering, and we were doing everything we could to get the money out as quickly as possible.
Right.
So the idea of waiting for maps was not an option when we were trying to stimulate the economy, which we successfully did. What we're looking at now, we have a little bit more time. We ought to be thinking about getting it as accurate as we can and making sure that we do have as accurate of account of where the service is and isn't. before we commit the money, rather than having the kind of urgency we did before. Now, when unemployment is 5 points lower than it was at the time when the economy is growing as opposed to contracting, and we're in a different environment. And these are long-term investments that are going to yield benefits for many years to come. And I certainly agree we need to get the maps as accurate as we can first before committing federal resource.
So just two real quick things. One of the things is what Jonathan said is absolutely right, and something we've been thinking a lot about is BTOP is different than what we're trying to do now, because BTOP was about spending money quickly on these issues, as opposed to right now we're actually trying to do it right in building the infrastructure and making sure we're doing that in the most efficient way. And one of the things that we include in this, in our bill, in our proposal on how to do this, is somewhat simultaneously, as you're allocating the money, if people think that the money is being allocated to the wrong place because the data is wrong, that they should be able to challenge it on the spot. And in some ways, we can improve the maps as we're spending it. It doesn't all have to be completely sequential. But a related problem that I think maybe we just have to have another panel on it, but we've talked a lot about rural, but I think some of these infrastructure problems we forget is an urban problem as well. And this is something I hear from my members. A lot of my members are from very urban districts, and they talk about that in very urban districts, I'm talking New York City, like middle of New York City, they still can't get access to high-speed broadband. And there's the affordability problem, but there's also just the access. And that there's places, there's areas that because of the economy of the certain blocks that we're talking about, they just weren't served. And that's something that I think we can't forget to focus on, and we shouldn't forget to talk about. I think 5G might be, and you know, the wireless, fixed wireless might be a way to help with a lot of that. That might be something that can help to change the economics of those areas. But I really think it's something we haven't talked as much, but I really don't think we should forget about either.
So I'm going to end this, unless you, Brad, you have 10 seconds, okay? To make sure everybody, I'm an equal opportunity panelist person. I want to end this just by saying something. Just first of all, thanks to the panelists for coming out. Let's give them a big round of applause. They behaved to the best of their ability, and we found out Rick Zimmerman's eating preferences. So that's something that we did find out.
Don't get in my way in the buffet.
I sure won't. And I also want to just leave with one note. Here at the Center for Technology Innovation, we are appreciative of your efforts to come join us today. Keep following us and the work that we're doing. This is one of several conversations that we hope to have on this issue. And I'd like to just leave with Jonathan's comment about waiting is no longer an option. I would say waiting for broadband is no longer an option. And so the quicker that we can accelerate this infrastructure plan with all these great ideas and make it bipartisan, the faster that we'll be able to make sure that everybody is connected. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a good rest of the day.